Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Our speaker is author Len Lyons. Dr. Lyons' lecture is titled, The Remarkable Unfinished Exodus of the Ethiopian Jews, Visiting Israel and Ethiopia. We begin with an introduction by Professor Linda Haywood from the African American Studies Program in the College and Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Boston University.
Professor Len Lyons earned his MA in Philosophy from Brown University. He is the author of 6 books on a variety of subjects, including jazz and computers, which were published by William Morrow and Company and Addison Wesley. Through hosting Ethiopian Israeli students visiting Boston in 2004, Dr. Lyons became fascinated with the story of the Ethiopian Jews and their struggle for acceptance in the country that rescued them. For more than 2 years, he has been meeting with Ethiopian Jews in Israel and in many sectors of the Ethiopian Jewish community. He serves on the Ethiopian Jewry Committee of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston. It's really my pleasure to welcome you here, Dr. Lyons.
So thank you very much, and thank you, Linda, for inviting me to be here. So the conference that I attended here was really wonderful and instructive, and it was about the Abrahamic faiths and Africa and African Americans. And interestingly, I just reread the description of the conference, and it was going back to the time of the slave trade. And of course, the interaction between Africa and the Abrahamic faiths goes back a long way before that. And in the case of the Ethiopians, probably as far as 200 years before Christianity. And so I'm going to start there and cover those 2,000 years, so of course I'll be leaving out a few details. But one thing that strikes me is that the interaction and the influences in both directions are really increasing in the last 10 years or so. For example, I want to call your attention to a fairly recent book called The Black Jews of Africa by Edith Bruder, who's a researcher at the School of African and Oriental Studies at the University of London. And this is it's very interesting that so many groups native to Africa, such as the Igbo in Nigeria, the Lemba in South Africa, the Abuyudaya in Uganda, and many other countries, Mali, Ghana, are claiming a Jewish identity that's being respected by the Jewish community the world over. And she, among other people, have been investigating these claims to understand what they're based on. So the Ethiopians are certainly the largest and the oldest of the groups that has identified with Jews. And although they are probably not responsible for these other groups identifying similarly, I think the Ethiopian community, which now numbers over 130,000 in Israel, with some remaining in Ethiopia, is certainly the largest, and I think they have prepared Jews around the world to be more receptive to the idea of the ethnic diversity within Judaism, which is certainly a lot more visible than it ever has been. So in that context, let me go further into the topic that I want to present you with today, which is, I call it lurching towards Zion, and I think you will understand why I use the word lurching after you hear the flow of this talk. But I would like to explain what the unfinished part of this Ethiopian exodus is all about. And there are really 2 senses. One is the full lack of integration that has been characteristic of the Ethiopian community in Israel. When I was working on the book, that I wrote about this community and their experience in Israel. And there are a few copies up here if you want to look at it afterwards. I asked everybody some standard questions. And one of them was, how do you identify yourself as Ethiopian, as Jewish, or as Israeli? And almost without exception, the choices were either Ethiopian or Jewish. But the Ethiopians have not fully felt comfortable with their Israeli identity for reasons that I think will be a little bit clearer as we progress. And in fact, in a clever way, an Ethiopian in Israel put this point very well. He was asked by a reporter, when did you arrive in Israel? And he said, well, I got here in 1992, but I'm still arriving. And this was some 10 years later. And I think that puts the point very well. He really hadn't felt acclimated. The other sense in which the Exodus is unfinished is that, amazingly, there are still Jews waiting to immigrate and who have been approved for immigration and who have been waiting in very, I would say, impoverished, if not dangerous, conditions in Ethiopia for as long as 10 years, even though they have been approved for immigration. And this is particularly surprising because, as you'll hear, during one of the dramatic operations that brought Ethiopians to Israel, Israel, the Air Force, and the IDF was able to bring more than 14,000 Ethiopian Jews to Israel within 36 hours. But a remaining 15,000 has taken 20 years, and they're still not there yet. And that's part of the story. It's one that's greatly complex and shows to me how complicated and messy, in a way, identity is. And these implications are still being played out today in Israel. The Ethiopian population of Israel is really only 1.5%. But they're very conspicuous, and their issues are, well, I hate to use a cliche like the canary in the mine shafts, but I think they're representative of a lot of problems in Israeli civil society. So they take up a great deal of the energy and attention of the media in Israel. One thing I'd like to make clear, because really it's still a factor in Israel now, is what the explanation is for the fact that there is a group of Ethiopians who see themselves as part of the Jewish people. So how did this happen? Well, there are ideas that I think of as legendary or rabbinic or religious. The most common one is that the Ethiopian Jews are descended from King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. And this is commonly believed, and it doesn't just apply to Ethiopians who identify as Jews. It's true, in a way, of all Ethiopians. As some of you might know, this comes from the folklore, the compendium of folklore about the origins of the Ethiopian nation in the Kebra Nagast, the glory of kings. And this was redacted in the 14th century, long after the events which were it was based on. In the Book of Kings and Chronicles in the Bible, there is mention of the Queen of Sheba visiting King Solomon. And Sheba here is derived from the Hebrew root Saba, which means south. So somewhere in the south, there was a queen who visited King Solomon. But this was as far as the Bible describes the incidents. But the Kebra Nagast attempts to extrapolate from this that the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon had more than a royal meeting, but had an affair in which the first emperor, Menelik I, was the product, and that Menelik was raised in Jerusalem in King Solomon's court and then went to Ethiopia to his mother's land, which is also known as Makeda, and that this was the origin of the Ethiopian nation, and therefore the Ethiopian Jews, in some sense, see themselves as descendants of King Solomon. But the fact is that many people believe that the Qebr Negas, which, as I say, was based on folklore but not preserved until the 13th century, was designed to uphold the Solomonic dynasty, which was a dynasty of emperors that ruled from about 1200 to the end of Haile Selassie's regime when he was deposed in 1974. And they had just recently, by recent I mean within the last 100 years before that, they had defeated the Zagwe dynasty. And to shore up support, this document, the Qebr Negas, is alleged by some people to have been a product of the attempt to bolster the claims of the new set of emperors to show they were descended from King Solomon. Now, the descendants of the tribe of Dan was an idea that was based on a 16th century Egyptian rabbi who was asked if an Ethiopian who had a child in Egypt, if that child should be considered a Jew. And he said yes, because they're from the tribe of Dan. Now, when in 1973, when the rabbinate in Israel wanted to validate the claims to Judaism of these Ethiopians, they referred to this rabbi's decision in the 16th century, believing that he was closer to the facts than they could be in the 20th century. But of course, he wasn't very close to the facts at all, and nobody really knows if they were from the tribe of Dan. So this is why I call these legendary and rabbinic points of view. Historically, there were Jewish communities in the southern Arabian Peninsula, now the area of Yemen. So there was some belief that during the original exodus from Egypt, instead of going across the Red Sea, there were people who went down to northern Ethiopia. Okay, again, there's no real validation of that. However, there's much more evidence of these Jewish communities here in Yemen, because a very famous rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, was documented to have visited them, and his travels were very carefully watched and documented by Jewish and non-Jewish historians very soon after these events. So this was before the Christian era, and the belief was that there was trading with the Aga people, who were part of the Aksumite Empire, and that through this trading, ideas and practices of the Israelites, and it's probably too soon to call them Jews at this point, because that's more Talmudic, but we'll get to that in a minute. It's these practices that were brought over through this trading and intermingling of the population of southern Arabia and the Aga people native to Ethiopia, which was then the Aksumite Empire. So I want to ask you to think of these two images. There's the traditional Ethiopian flag from about the 1890s to 1974. And in this flag, you see the Lion of Judah, the conquering Lion of Judah, which was part of the official pronouncements and laws of the Ethiopian Empire were issued in the name of this unmistakably Jewish or Israelite entity. And at the same time, this Lion of Judah is holding a cross. And here you see in 2011, a Falashmura man. He is wearing a traditional prayer shawl, a tallit. He's wearing the phylacteries. These are called tefillin in Hebrew. And they are what religious Jews wear to pray, except on the Sabbath. And as you can see, I hope you can see it, there's a cross tattooed on his forehead. Okay, so these are really statements of the intermingling of Christianity and Judaism early in Ethiopia's history, which is a very big factor in the story of Ethiopian immigration. I'd like to comment on the word Fala Shimura, a word that really nobody knows the meaning of, but it is a variation of falasha, which is a word you may have heard that used to refer to Ethiopian Jews. It was used for a long time before people realized that it was actually a derogatory term used by the Christians about the Ethiopian Jews who thought of themselves as Beta Yisrael, the House of Israel. Others called them falasha, and this comes from a 15th century Ge'ez term, falasi. That term was used by the emperor Yashak. Yashak, again, Ethiopic or Ge'ez and Amharic being Semitic languages, use some of the same names as biblical names. So Yashak is the same as Isaac. Yashak defeated the Beta Israel, who then numbered in the 100,000s, and declared that only a Christian, Ethiopian Orthodox Christian person, could inherit or own land. So from the 15th century, land ownership by these falasha was prohibited. So he decreed after defeating them that only the Christian can own land and everyone else would be falasi. So this was the first occurrence of the Ge'ez term falasha. It became falasha in Amharic. And it became stranger, someone who doesn't belong, foreigner. So this was used on the Beta Yisrael to isolate them. So Fala Shimura has a different definition, which we're going to discuss later. It's part of the reason the Exodus is unfinished. But as in much of this, once you look into it, things that labels that appear to be clear and simple are actually very complicated. So we talked about these Jewish communities in before the Christian era, and we know that there were Jewish or Israelite influences and practices in Ethiopia because of the early Christian practice. Early Christian practice in Ethiopia included Sabbaths on Saturday. It included circumcision on the eighth day. It included the same dietary restrictions as the Jews, not eating pork and so forth. In fact, Ethiopians, Orthodox Christians, still do not eat pork. There were many loan words from the Hebrew text that were part of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church. And eventually, the church tried to normalize the practice and change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday, for one example. And many of these early Ethiopians who were Christians but had Israelite and Jewish practices did not want to give up what their practice was. They were the conservatives of their day. And they fled the area of Aksum and went to the northern highlands, which is where the Ethiopian Jews of the 20th century, well, even as early as the 18th century, were seen by people who traveled there. So we have a lot of evidence that Christianity and Judaism, which we see as mutually exclusive in many ways, were combined in Ethiopia in the early practice, and this continued for centuries before it was outlawed. It's also relevant here that the Orit, which is the Bible, both the Christian, Orthodox Christian Bible, and the Jewish Torah, is used by both groups in Ethiopia. They use the same liturgical text. Obviously, the Beta Yisrael never use the New Testament because they rejected Christianity. But the Orit was translated from the Septuagint, which was a Greek version of the Bible. And therefore, they translated the Hebrew term Kush, which occurs frequently in the Bible, as Ethiopia. And therefore, Ethiopia is mentioned quite frequently in the Bible, something like 50 times. And as a result, it developed a great status and a kind of luster that Ethiopia should be ancient enough to be in the Bible, though actually it was a translation of Cush, and nobody really knows where Cush was, except that it was south of Egypt and that black people lived there. That those were the two things that are clear from the context of the Bible, but whether it's Ethiopia or not, nobody knows. The last point to make is that the Talmud, which is really the basis of rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism that's practiced by most of the world today, grew up in the 2nd to the 6th centuries. Ethiopia had no contact with the rest of the world, or certainly with the Middle East, at that time. And therefore, their practice of Judaism, when they were encountered by Jews elsewhere in the world, was completely different. It was really what was practiced in the time of the first temple, which was hundreds of years, centuries before the Christian era. So they would, for example, isolate women after childbirth, and Ethiopian Jews still do that today. They still, if a woman gives birth to a, and they're traditional, the woman gives birth to a daughter, they're isolated from their families for 80 days, if it's a male child, for 40 days. And this is in the book of Leviticus. But Talmudic Jews never practiced this. The Ethiopian Jews, even until the early 20th century, sacrificed a lamb on Passover. Jews in the rest of the world never practiced this. So this had a very important influence on how well these groups integrated, because although the Ethiopians were Jews, when they were brought to Israel, their practice was completely different. It wasn't a different religion entirely, but there were many differences about it, and that threw a lot of people. The reason that rabbis thought that the Ethiopian Jews were from the tribe of Dan was because there was a travel writer named Eldad Hadani, which means the Danite, who in the 9th century made a career of writing about lost tribes. There's a tremendous amount of interest in lost tribes at this time. And he said that he had seen in his travels black Jews on the other side of the river Cush. Okay, now, there's no other real documentation of this, and he didn't seem to know their practices, so the historicity of this is certainly in doubt. But this was a prevailing opinion. Same with Benjamin of Tudela, or Toledo, who traveled in the 12th century and said something similar. So this rabbi, David ben Solomon Abi Zimra, in the 16th century, was the one who decided, okay, this Falasha slave who gave birth to a child, the child must be Jewish because they're from the tribe of Dan. So it comes from these travel writings. And then further on, in the 1970s, when Ovadia Yosef, the Sephardic rabbi of Israel at the time, said, yes, these Ethiopians are Jews and we must bring them to Israel. This authorized the Jewish state to bring them in according to the law of return. He was relying on the 16th century decision, which itself depended on travel writing that it was really didn't have any independent verification. So Europeans come into the picture in the late 1700s when a Scottish explorer named James Bruce decided that he would like to locate the sources of the Nile River. It happens that one of the sources of the Blue Nile is Lake Tana in the northeast of Ethiopia. And when he found himself there, he realized that here were people who were, for all intents and purposes, Jews. They had distinctively Jewish practices. And so he came back to Scotland. It took him years to write I can't remember what it was called, I think it was Travels to Discover the Source of the Nile, something straightforward like that. And suddenly he wrote about these black Jews, and it happened that, and this was published, this book was published in the early 1800s, I think it was 1813. The Jews took no interest in this. But one group that did take interest was the London Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. They were interested, because they thought, here are Africans in need of salvation, let's convert them. So by the mid-1800s, they had sent several missions, which included some Jews who had converted to Christianity, to Ethiopia to find these Jews and convert them. And That got the attention of the Jewish community. And now that someone else was trying to get them, they took an interest. So the Alliance Israelite Universelle, a French-Jewish organization formed in 1860, sent Rabbi Yosef Halevi in about, I think it was 1867, to discover whether or not these people really were Jews and what could be done about it. So he went to Ethiopia and he wrote back, amusingly, that he thought they were Jews, but they didn't think he was Jewish because he was white. So he had to convince them, which he managed to do by recognizing the holiness of Jerusalem, which had been a long entrenched idea among the Beit Yisrael, that Jerusalem was a holy land, and that this was where their spiritual homeland was, which of course went along with the idea that of the Christians saying, you're Falasha, you don't belong here. So Yosef Halevi recommended that expeditions be sent to Ethiopia, but there were no takers. They couldn't get that going until one of his students, Jacques Faitlevich, went there in the early 1900s, 1904, and really he devoted the rest of his life until 1955 to uniting the Ethiopian Beta Yisrael with the rest of world Jewry, and to try, and this is a very key concept here, to try to, in air quotes, normalize their Jewish practice. That is, if you want to be Jews, you need to be Jews like we are. Okay, so that was a big assumption, and one they didn't take well to. But nevertheless, he gradually promoted them among Jews elsewhere in the world, and he helped educate some of them by sending them to Israel, to Europe, and so forth. And it gradually brought them in touch with the rest of Jewry. I underline this to remind myself, since I'm being invited by African American Studies Department, to say that among the places that Jacques Faitlevich went in the early 1900s was to New York in the 1920s. This had a great impact on a group of African Americans who were what is I think of as Black Israelites or Hebrew Israelites. And before I conclude, I want to tell you about a book that's coming out, which I think is extremely wonderful for understanding this group. That in any case, one of their leaders was Arnold Josiah Ford, who was an Israelite, believed he was descended from the original Israelites, and he was actively pursuing Judaism. Well, when he heard there were African Jews, and also being a very close associate of Marcus Garvey, he was the music director of the UNIA, as a matter of fact, this was irresistible to him. And he went, along with some of the congregants from his synagogue, Beth B'nai Abraham, to settle in Ethiopia. And he lived there for 5 years until he died of an illness, and attempted to unite his African-American Jewish movement with the Ethiopians. So this turned out to be a tragicomic episode, which is well documented in the book, which I'll tell you the title of right now so I don't forget to mention it. It's a book by a historian from Kansas University, Jacob Dorman, and it's called The Chosen People, The Rise of Black Israelite Religions in America. So this includes Christian faiths, Rastafarianism, what he calls Black Judaism. And I happen to know about this because I reviewed the book for a journal, and I think it's actually a wonderful book. In any case, I've already mentioned that at a certain point the rabbis needed to authorize the Jewish identity of this group so that they could be brought to Israel under the law of return. And this will come up in a few minutes. So from 1977 to 84, Jews were escaping the Mengistu regime, which had deposed and possibly assassinated Haile Selassie. And they were escaping on their own through routes that had been mapped out for them by some people who had already, some Ethiopians who had already been to Israel, and also by some American activists who were members of the American Association of Ethiopian Jewry. The Americans were a big factor in getting the Ethiopians to Israel, and this grassroots organization, the AAEJ, was particularly effective. And these were Jews who were coming out of the 1960s, who were intellectuals, professionals. They were involved in the civil rights movement. They had a great deal of empathy for black Americans. And here they suddenly realized they were black Jews in need of rescue. So Operation Moses, very well publicized, and maybe I don't need to go into this. There are a million places you can read about it. And incidentally, I have there are handouts somewhere which include a bibliography and a much more detailed timeline. And afterwards, those of you who are interested or want to pursue this can pick that up. There were, perhaps this is the most important statistic, between 1977 and 91, there were 22,000 Ethiopians who left Israel on foot. And during this immigration, 4,000 to 5,000 of them died in the process. I would like to also mention, since I'm mentioning other things you can take advantage of, Live and Become is a fabulous feature-length film about the Ethiopian escape to Israel of the 1980s and what happens to a young boy who grows up in Israel. Having come through the refugee camps of Sudan. So you can rent Live and Become from Netflix, and it's a great, great movie. So what happened in Israel? There was a transition from living in these huts in their own communities to living in apartment buildings where they knew no neighbors at all. There was a difference in the everyday life, from the cooking to cooking in an oven, but in an apartment where their six children had two or three rooms and where they didn't have a community, a sense of community. And there was a change in work, because the only work that were allowed the Beta Israel in Ethiopia was tenant farming and crafts. And this is because people looked at the Ethiopians very superstitiously. And now they moved to an information age economy. And how do they do? They do terribly, because housing is different. They are isolated. The children who learned to speak Hebrew, and the parents, 75% of whom were illiterate when they came to Israel, can't get along without the children. Anybody who has children knows you don't want them to be in control. You want to be the one that has the respect, the kavod in Hebrew. But this doesn't happen, and the parents are marginalized. For the first time, women are earning money and can divorce men. It never happened in their villages. Lack of marketable skills is obvious. Different customs. In Ethiopia, those of you who know something about Ethiopia, weddings include hundreds of people and they last for days. Well, these people feel very obligated to their family and their community, and they leave their employers for days in Israel. That's not good for their work career. One woman I know lost a job because she could not, according to her employers, relate to her community, her customers. And it turns out later it was realized that she was following the Ethiopian tradition of not looking someone in the eye if they're if they're older than you. She was in her 20s. She wouldn't look at the customers, but for her it was being polite. For them it was being ineffective. So there are many others, but they of factors, and we can go over them more. I went through that too quickly. But they lead to these headlines, which I grabbed from the 2012. Ethiopians are earning 30 to 40% less than Arabs. There's a great deal of poverty. There's a great deal of domestic abuse. The men are frustrated. They can't get work. They don't have authority with their children. And their wives have money, because the women actually do better than the men in this new society. And that may not be a surprise. But they are the ones who shepherd the children to the schools, and they end up learning more about the society than the men do. So what Israel is doing about this is to, I don't want to leave the impression that Israel is not trying to address this. So let me just tell you a few things that are happening in Israel to help acclimate the community. They live in an absorption center like this one for up to 18 months. They're given schooling. They learn Hebrew. They learn about the social service system. When they leave, they are given 80 to 90% subsidy to buy an apartment. 80 to 90%. And if their children get into a university, and there's no affirmative action, there's no special attempt to maintain a certain quota of Ethiopian students, but if they get in, they have free tuition. So this is why Israel says it costs $100,000 per immigrant for them to take the Ethiopians. So the problem is they're not doing enough, and they can't really do enough because this is a much bigger problem. What happened is that there were thousands of Ethiopians who were raised as Christians and whose parents were Christian but knew that they had Beta Israel ancestry. Because of all the attempts at conversion, because in Ethiopia it was very hard to be Falasha, you could not own land, obviously you couldn't get certain jobs, they were very restricted, and socially they were outcasts. So it was not an easy job to be a Beta Israel, and families starting in the late 1800s were leaving. Now their descendants, recognizing that they could be Jews and live in Israel, want to come back. There were thousands of them outside in these very crowded gates, and it was amazingly, they had, thanks to a couple of American organizations, the AAEJ and NACOJ, the North American Conference on Ethiopian Jewry, which still exists and is still operating, thanks to these organizations, they were very organized, and also the Jewish Agency for Israel, which is an Israeli organization, non-governmental, and they attempted to separate the Beta Israel from the Falashmura. And the fact is, they did it successfully, and the president at the time, Yitzhak Shamir, was asked, can we take these Falashmura? There are thousands of them. And after much deliberation, he said, no, you can't take them. We don't know if they're Jews. So as a result, the 3,000 Falashmura became 15,000 Falashmura and 20,000 Falashmura, ultimately 22,000 Falashmura over the next several years. And they all were wanting to go to Israel and saying, our families are there, and in fact, they could verify that the rest of their families were there. So we had a difficult problem here. We have family separation, and we have Ethiopians who say, yes, I was brought up as Christian, but I have Jewish ancestry. So what do we do? The law of return under which these Ethiopians came to Israel says that if you are a Jew, and this law was created in 1950, 2 years after the creation of the state, it's part of the mission of Israel to take in Jews, especially if they're vulnerable or persecuted. So they had to take them. It wasn't any choice. But here we have a dubious case where the mixed nature of Christianity and Jewish practice in Ethiopia still today has an impact on what's happening. So there is another law in Israel called the Law of Entry, which enables the Ministry of Interior to take in people from another country for humanitarian reasons, apart from whether or not they're Jewish. So the humanitarian reason here is that the families were separated. So the advocates for the Ethiopians, which included most definitely Americans and part of the Israeli lawmakers and population, says you've got to take them under the law of entry. And others say, no, they're being opportunistic. They didn't want to have anything to do with Judaism. They wanted to be Christian because it was too difficult. But now that they have an opportunity, they're coming here to improve their lives, which, of course, is very understandable. But is Israel obligated to take them, given that, number one, the Ethiopian population is not well integrated, number two, that there's a huge financial burden? Do they want to take thousands more? So there was a compromise, and here was the compromise. According to Jewish law, you are Jewish if your mother was Jewish, and her mother was Jewish, etc., going back, or if you have a conversion by an accepted religious body. The Orthodox movement, the conservative movement, these are fine points. But those are the two conditions. So what they said was, if these Ethiopians are considered Jews, then they need to assure that by conversion. Now, the Beta Israel in 1985, when they were first coming to Israel, were asked to convert. And they said, why? The rabbis have just said we're Jews. How can we convert to something we already are? And eventually, this got to be an angry protest. And they won the right to remain as Jews in the country without converting. But there were still people who said, well, we don't have record keeping in Ethiopia. We don't really know who their parents were. Divorce, which was not that common, occurred, but we don't know who the parents are. There's no way for us to know. So they were very skeptical. Now, actually, I misstated something. According to the law of return, as it was updated in 1970-something, it was liberalized to mimic the Nuremberg laws under which the Nazis would say the Jews, someone was of Jewish parentage. The Nazis considered anyone of Jewish parentage if one grandparent was Jewish. So that became, the original law of return was the way I stated it, but the law of return after 1970, I can't remember the exact date it was changed, but it was liberalized to include anyone who has a Jewish grandparent. And so that certainly could have applied to many Ethiopians, to the Fala Shmura. But they made an exception for the Ethiopians and say, well, if you're Ethiopian, then you must have matrilineal descent. It must be from your mother's side, because the original law, wanted to use the Hebrew term, the halakha, which is a Jewish law, says that it must be a Jewish mother. But the civil law says, no, it's good enough if you have a Jewish grandparent. We'll take you into Israel. But for the Ethiopians, they made an exception. It has to be matrilineal descent. So there's a couple of things I want to point out, and then I'll close here. One is the paradox of what I call bureaucratic identity. So the paradox is, you have Beta Israel, people who are living as Jews in their villages and with their families for decades, presumably centuries. And they say, we refuse to convert because this is what we are. So in Israel, people say, well, we don't really know, but you know, we accept the civil law, but we're going to withhold judgment as to your Jewish identity. But then you have a Fala Shmura man who has been living his life as a Christian. And he comes to Israel and he studies for the requisite amount of time, and he goes through the mikveh, the ritual immersion, and he goes through the symbolic circumcision, etc. And then he is converted, and the irony is that in the eyes of the religious authorities, the man who has lived his entire life as a Christian and spent 18 months to convert is, quote, more certainly Jewish than the man who has spent his entire life living a Jewish life but hasn't converted. For me, this is particularly interesting because it comes up in the case of the African-American Jews of today, who I have been writing about. And in the Jewish Daily Forward, which is a national Jewish paper, I wrote a story in July about this group. And again, they feel as part of the Black Israelite movement that they are descended from Jews, the original ancient Israelites, who they believe were black. and therefore they don't have to convert. So many of them don't convert. Although for generations, at least since the 1920s or so, many of these families have been living as Jews. But then if you compare that to a Reform Jew, a white Reform Jew who may not live a particularly Jewish life at all, compare them to the African American community, which is fairly orthodox in its practice, active. They tend to go to the synagogue every week, they observe the holidays, they keep the laws of kashrut, they eat only kosher food, etc. And because of this conversion issue, they are not looked at as Jews, while the Reform Jew who may do nothing at all and may have a Christmas tree in his house, he's a Jew if his mother was. So that's why I call this a bureaucratic definition, and I think there's something paradoxical here. And as ethnic diversity becomes more important among the Jewish people, quote, whatever that is and whatever the boundaries are, it's more important to understand whether the bureaucratic and official understanding of identity is sufficient to deal with the realities, and I think it isn't. So there are synagogues in Gondar, Ethiopia. These are some photographs. I have a lot of them, but I'm not going to show them now because I want to get to this final point, which is the family of Azana Makonnen, who is living in Gondar. He's been there 10 years waiting to immigrate. And he was there in 1999. And he went to the synagogue, and he is actually pretty conversant with Hebrew. He lives in one of these shacks. The family shares, I mean, just to give you an idea of the conditions that they've been waiting in for 10 years, they share a shower and a toilet with 40 people. There's no electricity, obviously. There's no, of course, there are cell phones, but there's no plumbing, no electricity in these houses. His wife teaches in the Hebrew school that was created in order to train the Fal Shmura in Hebrew before they actually got to Israel. She's somewhat competent in Hebrew, two beautiful children. And here he's holding a list which he himself, as an official of this community in Gondar, was responsible for maintaining. The list shows the descent of each of the people in this community. Then when I went, there were 6,500. Each of these lists contains the names of the people and who their parents were to determine if they were eligible to go to Israel. Now, the fact is, the law was changed, as I mentioned, in 2003. But he was there since 1999. So here's his name, Azana Bailey Makonnen. And the letter B by his name indicates that his descent is patrilineal, and so is his wife's. And therefore, after remaining here for 10 years, he can no longer use the synagogue because the rules were changed. His wife can no longer teach in the Hebrew school, and they can't come to Israel. And so they're really stranded in Ethiopia, and a lot of people are very upset about this. But it's a result of this compromise between the people who doubted the Fal Shmura and the people who advocated for accepting them. So I'd like to just close with some general comment about what I've learned from getting involved with the Ethiopian community. First of all, it's fascinating, and I love it, and I love Ethiopia. But it's also very instructive, because when you talk about identity, who people are, and have these comfortable concepts in your mind and labels, it's really not that realistic. And when you get into the issue of problems between communities and conflicts between identities, it's really important to understand what all the mixtures are that come with these oversimplified labels. The book I was telling you about before, The Chosen People, has one fantastic sentence in the conclusion of the book that I would like to end on. In the book, Dorman is describing how these black Israelite communities are formed out of a mixture of Freemasonry, of the Holiness Church, of black consciousness, Garveyism, and the idea that the African Americans are descended from the ancient Israelites. I mean, all these things are mixed together. And what he says is that they are riotously impure. And this polyculturalism, this mixture of people and their identity, challenges us to look at people as riotously impure. And to me, this is one of the lessons of this whole topic, that we don't know what we think we know. And we have to really take in the complexity of these groups, and how something so noble as Israel's taking in the Ethiopian Jews, which when it happened was billed as, this is the first time Africans are leaving Africa to be free. And yet it spiraled into a kind of complexity, confusion, and difficulty. So all of this just snowballs into a very tangled, fascinating, but sometimes a very heartbreaking situation. So thank you all for your attention.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by author Len Lyons. Dr. Lyons' lecture was titled The Remarkable Unfinished Exodus of the Ethiopian Jews, Visiting Israel and Ethiopia. It was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program in the College and Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderator was Professor Linda Haywood from the African American Studies Program. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.